The next case set for argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Matthew Carter. Wanda Howie Fox is arguing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Carter. And Paul Sweetland is here on behalf of the State of South Dakota and will be arguing. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Ms. Howie Fox, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. We are here, well, I am here today due to the situation that occurred with regard to Matthew. Matthew was invited by law enforcement down to the safety center in Yankton, South Dakota. He was interviewed. At the conclusion of the interview, he was taken into custody. He was not on a parole hold. He was not charged with anything. He was not charged with anything until he was indicted on January 11th of 2021. On January 12th of 2021, he made a phone call, which law enforcement listened to, as they are wont to do, and Detective Erickson took the opportunity to, rather than go get a search warrant based on his concerns with what he felt was in the telephone conversation, rather than go get a warrant, he went to the house that he had the keys to, went to the house without benefit of a search warrant, searched the house, and claimed to have found hard drives. He was authorized to approve the search of the residence, but as I understand, he did not approve. He was not contacted, and it was not until the next day, January 15th of 2021, that the detective went in and got a search warrant after the fact. After the search warrant was issued, there was an inventory done, and Matthew was then in, there was a superseding indictment on April 6th of 2021. During that period of time, what happened was the hard drives that law enforcement found in the house were turned over to the federal government. The federal government then indicted Matthew. Matthew was then tried for possession of kiddie porn. He was found guilty, and then on January 26th of 2022, the 5 days before the trial started on his case in Yankton County on the criminal charges of rape of a child, made the front page of the newspaper that Yankton man was found guilty of child porn. It was at that point, in our opinion, that the case where devolved from a case of rape of a child to a case of possession of child porn, because the evidence elicited at trial was not about rape of a child. The evidence elicited at trial was about basically child porn. It was various definitions of child porn, graphic descriptions of child porn, Google searches of child porn, and three videos of child porn were shown to the jury.
Well, if they meet the admissibility standards and have relevance to the charges at issue, what is the error in that?
We don't agree that they met the admissibility requirements to be shown to the jury. This was a case that devolved from rape of a child, which, in my opinion, the state had to show some indicia of penetration to a child. We have a situation where the child was found by the trial court to be unavailable. However, some of the child's statements to the grandmother, to law enforcement, and to Child's Voice were utilized. However, there are other statements made by the child about other potential perpetrators were not allowed in. Those were excluded. We then have the defendant's Matthew's expert not allowed to testify as to the...
Was there an order that prohibited the expert from testifying, or was the expert just not called? I know there was a Daubert hearing, and the court made a determination that was adverse to Mr. Carter, but that may not necessarily be the same thing as preventing his expert from testifying.
I was not trial counsel, but my review of the record indicates that Matthew's expert was denied the opportunity to testify because the court found that there was no reliability issue with regard to the testing. The NAAT testing, according to its own directions, is unreliable, is not to be used in a legal medical situation. Matthew was tested once. The state argued that it was too expensive to test Matthew more than one time, yet the child was tested five times.
There's no information in the record, or no proffer, for example, that the defense expert was proffered as a witness, even though the Daubert hearing, the NAT testing was coming in as reliable, but I can't locate anything in the record that says that there's a proffer from the doctor or any attempt by the defense to get in the doctor's testimony thereafter.
Again, I was not trial counsel, so I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage here.
Along those lines, is there any motion in the record or any motion to exclude the defendant's test results? Are you challenging the admissibility of the defendant's test results on appeal?
To an extent, yes, because he was not retested. He maintained that he did not have positive testing. He requested a retest, did not get a retest. The state's justification for that was it's too expensive for these tests. Well, I'm not sure how it's too expensive for the test to be done for Matthew, where the child is done five additional times. Mother tested positive for gonorrhea. Mother and Matthew's expert, as well as the expert that did testify on behalf of the state, said that gonorrhea can be transmitted by people with poor hygiene, under fingernails, through kissing, people who don't wipe themselves after using the bathroom. Yet that Matthew's expert was not, in my understanding, was not allowed to testify. It would be my position that the two experts both should have been allowed to testify, at which point the jury, who is the trier of fact, would have been able to determine which expert was more believable to them. That did not happen in this situation.
And you can't say whether or not defense counsel requested the opportunity to call the doctor based on your review of the record?
As I stand here today, I cannot say that with certainty. I can't inform the court of that with certainty.
Is there any place in the record where the court said, I won't allow this witness to testify with respect to the second testing part?
I believe it's in the court's findings of fact and conclusions of law, which are attached to our initial brief. And I can, when counsel for the state is presenting his argument, I can look for that for the court.
Just to clarify on the hard drive videos, are you contesting the admissibility of the hard drive videos and the text messages or on appeal or just the hard drive videos?
We don't think that the text messages should have been allowed in either.
And how about the cell phone searches?
The cell phone searches, I'm not sure what the cell phone searches have to do with rape. The cell phone searches were searches, as I understand, of different kinds of pornography. What different kinds, and there were a plethora of different kinds of pornography that the state's expert testified about. And it devolved down into child pornography.
So are you challenging them or not?
Yes.
And what's the basis?
Because it had nothing to do with the child allegedly being raped. If the court...
So purely irrelevant.
Yes. The... The court allowed some statements of the child to come in and some statements of the child not to come in. Matthew didn't have his Sixth Amendment right even to have his attorney cross-examine the child. The child...
What rule would you... The court determined that those were the statements that were allowed were non-testimonial. What rule would you rely upon to say that he had a Sixth Amendment right to cross-examine in light of that determination?
We believe he had a Sixth Amendment right to cross-examine the child or let in all of what the child's statements are. Don't just pick and choose what the child said. What was let in was an allegation that Matthew might have licked her girl parts.
So are you challenging the idea that the court found them to be non-testimonial?
Yes. The court, however, did not allow Matthew's attorney to discuss the other people that the child claimed had licked her lady parts.
So that's a different argument, though. But explain for me why the court was wrong in determining that it was non-testimonial. What's your theory about why the court erred in making that determination?
Because there was no right to confront the child and ask it questions.
Well, that's the conclusion that results from being non-testimonial. The court made a conclusion it was non-testimonial, so you don't have a right to confront. You're challenging, as I understand, the court's ruling, underlying ruling, that it was non-testimonial. Why was the court wrong in making that ruling?
Well, I'm not sure how it could be testimonial in light of the fact that there were no opportunities for questions to be asked. The child, on a variety of different situations or different occasions, said that the teacher at school and three of her classmates had done the same thing. And when the child was asked, "What has Matthew ever done to you?" he made me sad. "When did he make you sad?" "He made me sad when I threw chicken on the floor and he yelled at me." It just seems inconsistent in my mind that...
So that's kind of your argument. I'm sorry to interrupt. Forgive me. So that's your argument in some ways. You think that there was some disparate treatment with regard to how these statements came in or didn't come in. But surely you're not challenging the ones that... Well, I don't know what.
I'm sorry. I'm not understanding your question.
So your argument is that just on sort of, I mean, fairness principles or whatever, all of these should have come in or none of them should have come in?
Well, it should have all come in. And then the jury, as a trier of fact, should have been able to ascertain whether or not it actually even happened.
Because I thought your argument was not so much that some got in, some didn't get in, but then the ones that got in, you weren't able to confront the victim on.
And we were not. Well, trial counsel was not. Because all that was allowed to be testified to was the grandmother testified, child's voice doctor testified, and the detective testified. All of which told the same rote story. But what didn't get to come in is that part of the child's statement that this happened at school. This happened with three of my schoolmates. It was inherently unfair, in my opinion, that testimony was prohibited, retesting was prohibited, showing kiddie porn videos to the jury seemed to be appropriate in a rape case of a child does not, to me, make logical sense. I can understand that if the state had charged Matthew with possession of kiddie porn, then it would have all come in. But that was not what he was indicted for. He was indicted for rape of a child. And I think they bootstrapped up using the videos, using the hard drives that they didn't have a warrant for, and bootstrapped that all up to, oh, Matthew is a horrible person. And because he's a horrible person, he has to be guilty of child rape. And we would disagree with that. We think that this case should be reversed and should be remanded down with instructions that require the trial court, if tried again, that the child be allowed to be cross-examined. Nobody's going to be mean to a five or six-year-old child. That Matthew's expert be allowed to testify. That this child pornography not be allowed in. That the Google searches not be allowed in. And that the anything that was obtained by law enforcement before they got the search warrant be kept out. And that's what we're asking this court to do.
Thank you, Ms. Hiley-Fives. Mr. Sweetland, you can proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Five-year-old EW contracted vaginal gonorrhea. The only way a five-year-old girl can contract vaginal gonorrhea is through sexual contact with a carrier. And Matthew Carter was that carrier. Science has not identified a non-sexual explanation for gonorrhea in children. Carter tested positive for throat gonorrhea. In addition, Carter had this video library depicting the specific act of sexual contact with the child that EW reported to her mother and grandmother. So the sufficiency of the evidence of Carter's guilt is not reasonably in question here. Carter raises instead legal arguments regarding his trial, namely the admission of the videos, the reports that EW made to her mother and grandmother, and the NAT testing at trial.
Mr. Sweetland, if I could interrupt, the most conspicuous thing that sticks out, at least in my mind, as it relates to the other acts evidence, is the video clips. And in your submission to the court, you covered it, but you kind of covered it in not a criticism, but you covered it in connection with the search terms and the searches and things like that. Could we, should we view the class of evidence that is that video clip class of evidence differently? There are several, well, I know of at least one U.S. Circuit Court of Appeal that has commented that the prejudicial risk for unfair prejudice for these video clips particularly is tremendous.
Well,
Should we treat that differently is a terrible question, but should we treat that a little bit differently? Should we break that out a little bit and kind of concentrate on that for a moment?
Short answer, no. In Snodgrass, you had search terms, but you also had images from his cell phone that were shown to the jury.
Yeah, but Snodgrass is a little different case. There are about four or five images. Here we're talking about videos. Is that so there's a difference factually between these two cases in terms of admitting videotapes and admitting a couple of still photos?
I don't think legally there is. Jurors look at ugly pictures of things all the time in cases. They're instructed what to do with those images, and they follow those instructions. The fact that these are videos instead of images or searches, I don't think is a legal distinction. The evidence, what's on those videos, is highly probative. Mr. Carter claims he wouldn't have anything to do with that shit. He claims it's effed up if you are that type of person. He claims he wouldn't have anything like that in his house. He claims to have no sexual interest in children. He says people who would do something like that are horrible. He carried on at length about how he would have absolutely nothing to do with anything like that. And yet, here it turns out that he has this library depicting the very same act, coincidentally, that EW claimed he perpetrated.
So this is rebutting in some ways?
In some ways. It's impeachment. It's rebuttal. So it has – the question isn't whether it's prejudicial, because certainly that's prejudicial or detrimental to his case. The question is whether that prejudice is outweighed by its probative value. And certainly under the circumstances of this case – where he has all these vehement denials and disassociation from that act, it's legally relevant, and the probative value is higher than its prejudicial effect.
I'm going to pick a nit, but it's actually the risk of unfair prejudice. So it doesn't have to even be the actual prejudice. In my view, it's the risk of unfair prejudice. And even in cases sometimes where that deal directly with the contraband, which is child pornography. Courts are very careful, and I don't think there's categorical rules necessarily, but courts are extremely careful about this evidence, even when it is relevant to an element of contraband in a possession or a receipt case. This is 404B evidence, and you know, the argument from Mr. Carter is this became the tail wagging the dog on this rape case. Your thoughts?
I think that's his arguments, but I don't think that changes the legal relevance of it. I don't think that it becomes somehow unfairly prejudicial because it's a video versus a still image. Mr. Carter said he would have nothing whatsoever to do with this type of act, and it turns out he has quite a bit to do with this type of act. He had gonorrhea, she had gonorrhea. The sexual act that he alleged to have occurred, or that EW alleged to have occurred, is capable of transmitting gonorrhea to the child. So under the circumstances, the probative value of this evidence was very, very high.
Counsel, I have a question. If I could turn you to the child's statements. When the grandmother started videotaping the child, wasn't she doing so with an eye to making a report to the authorities, which she did on Monday after the Christmas holiday? Isn't this testimonial, therefore, and subject to the confrontation clause?
No, Your Honor. She herself is not a law enforcement agent. And the child makes the statement, first of all, she makes the statement, and that's what prompts her to get the video in the second place. So
well, let me stop you there, though. I don't think the Supreme Court ever said, and we haven't said, it has to be law enforcement. Generally, that's where it happens, where you have investigative questioning and things like that. But the third categories the U.S. Supreme Court identified, and we identified in Richmond, is where a statement is made under circumstances which would lead an objective witness reasonably to believe the statement would be available for use at later trial. So here you've got grandma seeing what the little girl is doing, and she's saying, wait a second, I want you to show me that, and I want you to tell me and tell me how that impacts her, and she turns her phone on and starts videoing it. So that's preserving that what her granddaughter is telling her for something.
Your Honor is correct that the statement doesn't necessarily have to be made to a law enforcement agent. However, and so because many statements are made, for example, to Child's Voice, and some of those were excluded because they were in a more law enforcement testimonial type setting.
So why did Grandma record it?
Because the child just made a very disturbing remark, and the grandma obviously wanted to have more than just her own word about...
More for what?
Excuse me?
More than her own word for what?
That the child had made these allegations. The grandmother didn't know that
right,
the child...
Right, for what purpose, though? To convince law enforcement that something bad happened to her granddaughter.
So that they'd be more believable than just coming from her. The mother and the daughter had a contentious relationship. And in fact, the daughter, despite the evidence in this case, the daughter was not a cooperative witness in this prosecution. So if it's just the grandmother's word against the daughter's word, it's a lot less convincing than if there is this video. So the grandmother's smart. She knew to memorialize the evidence, and that's what she did.
She was just trying to convince the daughter and not a court later?
I don't know that she's trying to convince anybody. She simply
wants... You just
said
it was her was more convincing than mother.
Excuse me?
You said it would be more convincing than. Convincing to who?
Well, I think if the grandmother certainly knows her daughter, and she knows that maybe my daughter's not going to believe me when I say this. So she gets the video made.
To try to convince the daughter or to try to convince law enforcement?
Could be both. But certainly with the relationship that she had with her daughter, she had to be concerned that the daughter wouldn't believe her. And as it turns out, that's a very justifiable concern because the daughter was reluctant in this case to accept the fact that this man that she was living with, that she planned on marrying, was doing this to her daughter. So
could you also briefly address the situation regarding Carter's status on parole and The retrieval of the hard drives from his bathroom ceiling, and whether or not that was a search warrant was required, or whether or not it was done under authority of his parole status through his parole agent. What does the record reflect?
Well, I don't think the record reflects enough. I just heard Ms. Howie say that, well, the probation officer didn't prove that. I don't know that that's true. I think we need a record from the probation officer. We need a record from the officers, what they did, why they did it. So I don't think we have a record at this point to say that there was a manifest usurpation of a right here. We need to hear from counsel. Why didn't counsel file a motion to suppress? I don't think that the issue is ripe for resolution in this court. The record just isn't there yet. So, and as far as the statements are concerned with EW, Justice Salter, I think you hit it on the head there, that these were non-testimonial. They were statements made to her mother, not through any prompting. In addition, the grandmother. The statements made to the grandmother really weren't in response to any prompting. Child is bathing this doll. It seems to have a preoccupation.
Well, let me stop you there, though. She turned her phone on, and then she asked the victim some questions. She said, you know, show me what you're doing there. And then she says, well, how does that make her feel? And so she is prompting her, isn't she?
Well, it's her doing it. It's not law enforcement doing it. And so when we get into these situations of, well, the child said something to a non-law enforcement agent, like a child's voice counselor, you run into these situations where sometimes law enforcement is directing what questions to ask, and then those questions are asked by somebody else. There wasn't a law enforcement officer in the bathtub telling her, you know, ask her this question or ask her that question. So under the circumstances, no, I don't think there was anything testimonial about it. The fact that she wanted to preserve this statement on her phone, I think that was prudent under the circumstances, given her relationship with her daughter. And the statements to the mother and grandmother were properly admitted as being entirely non-testimonial.
Were they fundamentally different? My question is it all that significant? Even if the grandmother's questions or recording are testimonial, would that type of testimonial evidence be that fundamentally different from the earlier disclosures that were seemingly not testimonial? In other words, even if they're testimonial, does it really matter? Because there's other ones that are not testimonial.
Well, I think it's my position that they're completely non-testimonial. If they're testimonial, then that can implicate the Confrontation Clause question here. But the circumstances in which those statements were made, the act of disclosing it to the grandmother initially for the first time, completely spontaneously done by the child, same thing with the mother. And I think it's important to remember that the child made these statements separately. The grandmother didn't know that the child had made a statement already to the mother about this thing, and vice versa. So I think that, as the court found, is a strong indicia of reliability of the statements. So if the court doesn't have any other further questions, do you want me to address the NAT testing? Or?
Yes, please.
Okay. Carter's argument is a little bit confusing. He makes kind of three different arguments. The argument that he makes here on appeal in the initial appellate brief is that the testing as to him should not have been admitted. As Justice Salter pointed out, it was more a Daubert issue at the trial level. Here, the issue in the initial brief is you should not have admitted the testing, my testing.
Is that preserved? There doesn't seem to be an objection when the test results in Carter were admitted.
Well, the basis for his objection, yes, they were admitted because the disclaimer that he relies on doesn't apply to him. It only applies to children. It only applies to young boys and young girls and certain types of tests within that. So, yes, it was admitted as to him because there is no question of reliability for NAT testing in adult cases.
But was it preserved? Was it preserved?
As to Carter?
That was Justice Kern's question.
Oh, No, I don't think it was. I think it was preserved as to the child through this Daubert hearing, but no, not as to Carter. And I don't think any of the other arguments are really preserved here on appeal. I addressed them in my brief simply to make the court comfortable with the reliability of this NAT testing. But as to Carter, no, I think he makes an argument that's new here on appeal. And the other arguments concerning the reliability as to children and... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Does the record reflect that Carter sought to introduce the testimony of Dr. Dmitrovich to talk about reliability of NAT testing or to rebuttal to refute the state's experts?
I think that's what the Daubert hearing was. It was his effort to say, look, I want to introduce this testimony. The court said, no, you can't. Experts can't be conduits for otherwise inadmissible evidence like manufacturer disclaimers. So I think that was his effort to preserve.
So there is an order somewhere in the record where the court says Dr. Dmitrovich cannot testify?
That'd be the findings of fact, conclusions of law following the hearing. That's.
Do they reference Dr. Dmitrovich? There's no proffer on Dmitrovich. We'll hear from Ms. Fox on that shortly.
It was pretrial.
It was all pretrial, Your Honor. Yes, yes.
Right. Ms. Howie Fox, you can proceed with your five-minute rebuttal.
Thank you. I got a little involved in counsel's argument, so I wasn't looking at the findings of fact and conclusions of law as I should have been. However, what did stick out to me is counsel's argument that Grandma took the video because the grandma and the mother had a contentious relationship. I think what the court needs to focus on is the fact that Matthew and Mom broke up right before Christmas, either on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, which is why Mom took the child to Grandma's house and dropped the child off at Grandma's house for several days. Then, it goes without saying that the record reflects that Grandma does not like Matthew. And then there's some period of time where the child is in the bathroom washing her dolly. And she's washing the back of the dolly. And the video shows she's washing the back of the dolly and she washes the feet of the dolly. There's nothing in that video that reflects that the child is saying Matthew did anything wrong to her. However, it then goes to Mom, who clearly does not like Matthew, goes to law enforcement, goes to Child's Voice, and eventually takes the child from the mom for a period of time. And that just, in our opinion, goes with why the entire situation evolved in the first place. Grandma wanted the kid. And Grandma got the kid based on the fact that Grandma said, Matthew's doing something. And says the child says that Matthew's doing something.
So I'm confused, and it may be my fault. Help me out here. It appears that you just argued to me that the video taken by Grandma does not contain any statements by the child that Matthew did anything to her.
It shows the child washing the dolly. I don't get from that video any sense that Matthew was putting any portion of his body into the dolly or into the child, that he was licking the child, that he used any other object.
So if it came in, it's not prejudicial?
I'm sorry?
So if it came in correctly, it's not prejudicial?
Well, no, it's clearly prejudicial because... Grandma then says, this is what the child told me before we started the video. Well, how do we know what the child really told her before she started the video? Because she was an individual, and it was clearly her intention, in our opinion, to get that child. The child, on the other hand, claimed she can't remember Matthew doing anything wrong other than yelling at her
about
chicken. That
all seems like a sufficiency of the evidence argument, and... I don't see that one raised. I mean, if the argument is he shouldn't have been found guilty, I mean, we have these other issues that are identified that I think are more prominently presented. That one seems fact-bound.
I'm sorry?
That one seems fact-bound to the facts in this case, and it's maybe a sufficiency argument. But maybe I'm wrong.
I think that the court needs to look at all of the whole situation in its entirety. Counsel argues that Matthew had a plethora or a virtual library of kiddie porn. Well, I think if the court goes back and looks, the court will find that the hard drives, there is no evidence elicited as to when the hard drives were ever accessed last. And Matthew's father, Stephen Carter, had been convicted of possession of child porn and had been sentenced in federal court on possession of child porn and gone to prison for possession of child porn. We don't have anything that shows that that was actually Matthew's.
Counsel.
I'm sorry?
Special Agent Russell testified that on the hard drives, there was personal identifying information, including Carter's unemployment documentation, his apartment information and photos, was found in the ceiling tile above his bathroom, and he called it my gold, and directed his father to go and get it in the recorded messages from the jail.
I believe that, Your Honor, what the court is talking about, there were two hard drives, and then there was a phone and a second phone. The second phone is where the recent Google searches were, not on the hard drives. But I'm out of time. It would be our position that, as Benjamin Franklin once said, it is better that 100 guilty be free than one innocent man be convicted.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case is now submitted. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.